Good morning and welcome to the programme. Today, as the government is warned about potential food shortages and massive inflation hikes, we'll debate what can and should be done to help. President Biden heads from the United States to Europe today for talks with NATO and EU leaders on the next steps as Russia continues its bombardment of Ukraine. The bear man of Bunkrana had big plans to rescue two brown bears from a dog pound in Russia. Cillian McLaughlin will join us a little later. And our regular GP, Dr. Maura Finn, will be telling us about type 2 diabetes today. She'll take your questions on symptoms and treatment for type 2 diabetes. And if you have any questions, do get them into us now. Our text number is 51551. Email today, cb@rte.ie, or on Twitter, we are at Today with Claire. Today marks the 28th day of fighting in Ukraine. Humanitarian corridors will be in place in 9 areas of the country today. However, Irina Vershuk, the country's deputy prime minister, has said that no agreement has been reached with Russia to establish a safe corridor from the heart of Mariupol, and it's believed about 100,000 civilians remain in the besieged city with no food, no water, no medicine, and under constant bombardment. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Keir Giles, who is senior consulting fellow of the Russia and Eurasia programme with Chatham House, about the scenarios that could unfold to bring an end to the fighting. But first, to the disappearance of photojournalist Max Levin, who was reporting from a front line near Kyiv. It has raised serious concern about the safety of journalists reporting from Ukraine. Sarah Firth is a freelance journalist who works alongside Max, and Sarah joins me on the line now. Sarah, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. As I said there, you know Max, you've worked with him many times. Can you tell us about the circumstances surrounding his disappearance?
Yes, thank you. Max Levin is an incredibly talented Ukrainian journalist and photojournalist and cameraman, and he's missing right now. He's been missing since March 13th when he was filming outside of Kyiv on the outskirts, and the last message received from him was at 11:23 a.m. on March 13th. His colleagues are now asking for any information anyone has about Max after March 13th, anything at all. And they can contact Max's Ukrainian colleague, Markian, via the imi.org.ua website that has information about Max. And there's a link to Markian's contact at the bottom of that page. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders are also across this and can be contacted. I worked with Max, as you said, many times. And what you should know about Max is how kind and just totally committed he is to his job as a journalist. He is so focused on his work. He works almost entirely without vanity or ego. You will almost certainly have seen Max's work from Ukraine, probably without realizing it. And when you work with Max, you understand exactly the type of journalist that you want to be. He sets the bar so extremely high for all of us.
Yeah. I know this.
I want people to know that he's always taking the time to help and advise. Okay. And now we need help getting information about him, please. Okay.
And I can hear that you're upset, and this is not easy for you because your friend and your colleague is missing now for 10 days. But you decided to go public with this, along with his family and his other colleagues, in the hope of just getting some information on where he might be, what might have happened to him. This, for you, is the only resort.
Yes. And everyone is just desperately hoping for help here and for information about Max and that he comes home safe. And so any help right now is just so critical. And, you know, those facts that I've given you, those are the important facts right now that he's been missing since March 13th. And just, you know, as I said, Max is just such an incredible journalist. He is incredibly well known here in Ukraine, and he is so well loved. And as I said, you know, working with Max on the ground, he is just the very best of us. He is an incredible journalist. He is so empathetic, so focused on the story. It's never about himself. It's always about the story and the people that he is reporting on. And he just does that with the most unbelievable empathy. And so now his colleagues need help getting information about Max.
I know.
And Max is always the first to help and advise other journalists on the ground. So now he needs our help.
I know you need to be careful about the detail that you give us about the circumstances of his disappearance. But can you tell us anything more about that, Sarah?
Just that he was filming on March 13th on the outskirts of Kiev in an area that there was reports of very heavy fighting that day. And he's been missing ever since. The last message received from him, as I said, was 11:23 a.m. that day. So Markian and his colleagues are just looking now for any information at all about Max after that day. And any information anyone can give, any help anyone can give right now, that is so important. And as I said, it's imi.org.ua where you can reach Markian and get his contact.
Sarah, I want to ask you a little bit about what you're seeing where you are. You're in Lviv, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like there now, because we know that was the hub, or is the hub rather, for people who are trying to move from the east to the west and out of Ukraine. Is it still packed with people trying to make that journey?
The crossings have eased up a little bit over the last week or so. So I've reported from Kiev, and then I took the train along with lots of evacuating civilians to report that story, crossed the border into Poland, was down at the Polish-Hebrenne border for a week, and now back in Lviv. And so the crossings have eased, but they're still happening every day. There is a huge, huge humanitarian effort underway with various NGOs and charities that are on the ground in Poland and just crossing through, bringing, you know, critical life-saving medications and necessities to provide, you know, hospitals and doctors and people here in Ukraine with what they need right now. And there's also a big evacuation effort underway for the children and families that have been evacuated from other areas of the country that are under attack and are arriving here in Lviv and need to be evacuated.
And we know about the situation in Mariupol. It is desperate and there are still people who are trapped there. But similar stories now emerging from the city of Kherson.
Yes, there's lots of areas right now where people remain trapped and desperately in need of help. The people we've been speaking to over the last few days here in Lviv, are lots of people who've evacuated from those areas that are under siege or under very heavy attack. And their stories of, you know, being in basements, sometimes with very sick children that, you know, needed medical attention. Managing to escape, and you know, we've just met a lot of people who are exhausted and just devastated by what's happening in the country. And everyone right now is just so hopeful that there will be some progress in the peace talks and an end to this conflict.
I'm sure people are putting great faith or great hope in the fact that NATO is coming together, that US President Biden will be there and will also be meeting EU leaders as well. Are people hoping that there might be some sort of a breakthrough after that happens?
Yes, there's always hope. And I think Ukrainians have been just incredible to, it's been incredible to witness how strong and defiant and brave and courageous everyone has been in the face of this situation, which is unimaginable. And, you know, people are just doing what they need to do right now to survive, to protect their families, to protect their loved ones, and to protect civilians who need help right now. And so everyone's just very focused on that, you know, and there is just this huge, huge show of support and solidarity from Ukraine's neighbours in the world. And that means a huge amount.
Sarah, thank you very much for joining us, and we wish you well in your continued search for photojournalist Max Levin. The Economic and Social Research Institute, the ESRI, they've published their latest analysis of the economic consequences of the invasion of Ukraine, highlighting consumer price increases and continuing supply chain disruption. And you will have heard some discussion of this throughout the morning, but they've released some detail in the last few minutes, and they say increases in consumer prices are likely to accelerate as the conflict disrupts energy markets, and as a consequence of higher prices and greater uncertainty in global trade and investment, the ESRI expects GDP and MDD to be lower in 2022 than previously forecast. At present, they anticipate GDP to increase to 6.2% this year. Inflationary pressures, which had already been mounting in the latter half of last year due to supply chain problems and a rapid recovery in consumption, is likely to intensify as a consequence of the invasion of Ukraine. The ESRI goes on to say economic sanctions imposed on Russia and disruptions to supply are likely to persist and feed into consumer prices. And given those uncertainties, the ESRI now anticipates the average inflation of 6.7% in 2022 and 5% in 2023. And we'll be joined a little later on by Fine Gael TD and Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Martin Hayden, and Sinn Féin TD and spokesperson on agriculture, Matt Carthy, to debate the government's response so far to these pressures. But now, as we approach the fourth week of Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine, which has unleashed the biggest and bloodiest security crisis to unfold on the European continent in many modern times, the question arises as to what are the likely outcomes that will end the conflict. Well, here to talk us through some of those scenarios is Keir Giles, Senior Consulting Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Programme with Chatham House. Keir, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
What do you think that Vladimir Putin's strategic thinking could be at this point? Because he must have realised, we imagine, that there's no imminent capture of Kiev coming down the tracks. NATO is being very restrained in its response, though. Would you assume that his aims have changed at this point?
Well, it does seem that way, because both the Russian and the Ukrainian sides have said that the content of the peace talks have actually changed. They've changed from Russia just delivering ultimatums, which, let's not forget, were effectively for the disbandment of Ukraine as a state, to actually having a concrete conversation about how the conflict might end. Now, certainly President Putin must be aware that he didn't win the war in 48 hours as expected. But the question, of course, is how exactly he thinks it's going for real. What information is reaching him about what's actually happening on the ground and the reasons why his forces are not making their progress? And that is what will determine what his eventual war aims will be. Certainly they're shifting, but whether they're shifting fast enough to actually resolve the war in a short space of time is another question altogether.
Because he has to come to terms with the fact that this hasn't gone to plan, and that may take some time for him, for that to settle with him. Then he's got to move to the point where he's willing to talk. And we know that the Ukrainian president has called for face-to-face talks with Vladimir Putin. How likely is that to happen?
It's the only way of ending the war. Whether it's likely or not, of course, we don't know. But yes, it's essential for President Putin to actually have that conversation firsthand. It's become increasingly plain that the war was launched because Russia's leadership believed its own propaganda. They believed their own stories about how Ukraine was not a real state and this would be a swift war of liberation. And it's in order to break through that alternative reality that is surrounding President Putin that Zelensky is actually asking for these face-to-face talks, because there's no way of telling from the outside just what picture of the world President Putin is actually receiving.
Now, what about the Russian strategy, its invasion strategy? Because it hasn't gone well for them on the ground, but it would seem, looking at what has happened thus far, that the Russians didn't expect to be as active on the ground as they have needed to be.
No, that's quite right. Russia did not fight the war that it spent a decade and trillions of rubles preparing to fight. They thought it was going to be a pushover. They thought it'd be welcomed with open arms. And that's why they sent in this haphazard crowd of soldiers as opposed to an organized army. But then from about day five of this war, the stalemate has set in and the change in Russian tactics has become clear. They failed to win the war cleverly through military operations. So they fell back on the default Russian option of trying to cause as much civilian suffering as possible in order to pressure the victims of their aggression into making concessions and into surrendering, because that is exactly the choice they want to put Ukraine's leadership in front of.
So when we look at what might bring this to an end, and everyone just wants a ceasefire at this point so that there can be some space for an ending to appear, Putin is going to have to go back to his people, isn't he? And he's going to have to be able to say, I have a victory and this is what it looks like. What does it need to look like in order for that to work?
It really doesn't matter what it looks like in real life, because Russia's control on its own domestic information environment is now so tight that it can spin the facts whichever way it likes. It could walk away now and claim that there is a victory because it has demilitarized Ukraine, which was one of the objectives that was set out to start with. It could say, we've taught Ukraine a lesson, we've destroyed their army, they are no longer a threat to us, and sell it as a victory at home. It's more a case of what President Putin thinks he could achieve by carrying on that will determine whether the war continues or not.
Do you think a split Ukraine could be possible?
It's no longer as possible as once it was. Certainly, before 2014, there was this division in Ukraine between those who possibly had greater sympathy with Russia and those who did not, and that followed more or less geographical lines. But one of the biggest impacts of this war has been President Putin uniting not Ukraine with Russia, as he intended, but actually Ukraine itself. He's brought Ukrainians together just as the same way he's brought NATO and the EU and the West together to denounce this aggression. So, yes, if we were to split the country, it would inevitably be an occupation by Russia with fierce resistance to it in part of the country.
Because we've seen his determination to destroy and capture Mariupol. How does that play into any eventual settlement?
It's only a surprise how Russia is acting to people who have not watched how Russia has been acting before. There was always a lot of suggestion before this war started that it would be impossible for Russia to occupy parts of Ukraine because they would never win the hearts and minds of the people. But that ignores the fact that that is not important to Russia. They are quite content to flatten a city rather than win its heart and minds.
And the US president traveling to Europe today, is there anything that could happen in the next few days when it comes to EU and NATO talks involving him that might hasten the end of this?
Well, when you look at the past history of when Russia has ended wars without the full conquest of its enemies, the one thing that has always tipped the balance is the prospect of a foreign intervention that might actually make sure that this escalates beyond where Russia wants and it goes against it. Unfortunately, the likelihood of NATO, of the West, actually joining in on Ukraine's side is now so slim because from the very early stages of the conflict, the United States, the UK, all of Ukraine's foreign partners said that they would not get involved and went ahead and gave the green light to Putin to intervene. So anything that climbs back from that now is a huge escalation on the part of the West.
Yeah, and of course he knows, you know, that the no-fly zone is a non-runner. So maybe he's just playing for time, wear down the Ukrainians, wear down the EU even, because we know about the reliance of the EU on Russian oil. Is that part of his strategy, do you think, that he will just play this for time because he knows that the West isn't going to go further than sanctions?
It's certainly an option. Now, Russia does have a history of starting wars very badly, but then being willing to pour in sufficient resources, sufficient men, sufficient energy and money into it, that eventually they grind down the opposition through sheer weight of numbers and sheer mass. But then it's a question of Ukraine's resilience, not only military resilience and how swiftly they can absorb the military aid that is coming into the country, but also the human factor as well, whether Russia can, in this war of national survival, actually sustain the level of human suffering that Russia is willing to inflict.
The Americans very concerned. President Biden gave a stark warning about the potential use of chemical, biological, nuclear weapons. How likely is that?
Well, it's frankly surprising that we haven't seen chemical weapons used yet. And it may be that this policy from the US of intelligence disclosure is actually warning what Russia is planning to do before they do it, has played a positive role here, because we've seen multiple instances where Russia seems to have been headed off from a plan by it becoming known in advance. But the nuclear aspect is a different one. And President Putin does often threaten nuclear use when he wants to frighten other parties away from interfering with whatever Russia's plans are. Each time he gets a very excitable response, because each time people have forgotten that this is a perfectly standard part of the rhetoric. It's a diplomatic move, not a military one, to try to frighten people off.
And there has been talk, hasn't there, of whether Putin might use a demonstration effect, a high altitude detonation, just to show his willingness to deploy weapons of mass destruction, a demonstration of that. We know he has missiles capable of delivering conventional and nuclear payloads. Do you think that is an option that he may be considering?
It's true, there's been talk of that, but all of that talk comes from the West. All President Putin has to do is mention the N-word, and the Western media and a lot of Western politicians send themselves into a tailspin, speculating about what he might do. None of this actually comes from Russia. It's sufficient for him to set the ball rolling in order, once again, for Russia to set the bounds of the conflict and make sure that nobody else gets involved.
Questions have also been asked about his strategy when things go wrong. You know, what is he going to do next? Like, is he waiting for a bigger battle to unleash more of his air power, waiting to see what NATO does?
Well, he knows already what NATO does, because NATO has stated very clearly that it's not going to get involved. And this is where the fact that NATO has painted itself into a corner, not just NATO, but individual Western countries have blocked off their options by repeatedly saying what they won't do to help Ukraine. But in terms of Russia holding its combat power in reserve, there aren't many signs of that. It seems that it's actually effective Ukrainian air defense that has kept Russian aircraft out of the skies, for example. Russia not achieving that air supremacy in the very early stages of the conflict that everybody was expecting. The fact that Russian combat power hasn't fully been brought to bear seems to be more a function of effective Ukrainian resistance and Russian overconfidence and undercompetence in the early stages rather than Russian restraint.
Okay, I was reading some refugees who are travelling to this country, to Ireland, and they're very hopeful that they're going to get back to Ukraine very soon. What's the likelihood of that happening? Do you see a long road ahead, a long war stalemate?
Well, there is always hope, but let's not forget how this has worked out previously. It's been years, decades, generations sometimes before the victims of Russia's wars of conquests can actually go home. I would like to hope that it is sooner than that for the people who are leaving now, but we have to be ready to settle in for the long haul.
And is that what you expect to happen?
At the moment, it's a fine balance. Nobody would have expected when this war started that here we are 4 weeks later with effectively precisely the same situation as we had just a week into the conflict. Now, again, it's a battle of strength, it's a battle of wills, and it's a battle of resilience and patience between the two sides and who can actually hold out for longest. And that, at this point, is anybody's guess.
Keir, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Keir Giles, Senior Consulting Fellow of the Russia and Eurasia Programme with Chatham House on the line there. And coming up next, we'll have more on President Joe Biden's visit to Europe. That's coming up after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
It's expected that the US President Joe Biden will escalate sanctions on Russia as the international community looks set to send a powerful message to Vladimir Putin when they meet for an extraordinary NATO summit in Brussels tomorrow. As shelling continues to devastate Ukraine and civilian casualties increase, particularly in the port city of Mariupol, President Zelensky has been appealing for help and calling once again for a no-fly zone. Oleksandra Matveychuk is a human rights lawyer who is the head of the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine, and she joins us from Kiev. I see, Oleksandra, from your Twitter feed that you're reporting that there are buses of civilians. They've escaped from Mariupol. We know the awful situation. They're trying to flee. But you're hearing that those buses have been diverted by Russian soldiers. Can you tell me what you're hearing?
We got information for several days that Russians forcibly moved people from evacuation corridor to territory of Russia or to the occupied part of Ukraine. And this is a very cynical gesture and a huge violation of international humanitarian law.
And has anybody heard from those people who have been taken, I think, in this latest incident to Donetsk?
We got information that some buses appeared in Donetsk, and the people were forcibly take off passports. But we now in process of checking this information. It's very difficult to check.
Okay, and before we talk about what's happening on the international stage, and we know that President Biden is travelling from the United States to Europe today, and we'll talk about that in a moment, what has it been like for you over the last couple of days and indeed overnight in Kiev?
We are constantly under Russian shelling, and every day, every night, they destroyed another residential building and civilian objects in different districts of Kiev. I'm very afraid that Russians will transfer Kiev into the same which they transfer Mariupol. So Mariupol, 18 or 19% of city are destroyed completely.
And you have a real fear, as you talk to us, that this same fate might wait ahead for Kyiv.
Yes, and that's why we ask from Joe Biden and from NATO and from all leaders of Western democracies to stop this to close the sky over Ukraine, or at least to provide us middle and long-range weapons, in defense systems, drones, fighter jets, etc., in order to protect Ukrainian sky.
And you know the counter-argument to that and why the Americans and NATO and the EU have said that a no-fly zone would cause this situation to escalate beyond Ukraine. What do you say to that?
But what is the alternative? Putin will not stop in Ukraine. If he destroyed Ukraine, he will go further, and you will have to close the sky not over Ukraine but over another country.
What do you hope that Joe Biden will announce today? We know that there are more sanctions coming, but does he need to do more on the military aid side?
Yes, sanctions is not enough. And when we go into details, we see that it's not complete sanctions. For example, if we speak about SWIFT, only several Russian banks are banned from SWIFT. Among them, there is no Sberbank, which is the biggest bank of Russia. So we need more to freeze Russian economy and stop their ability to feed this war and to provide Ukrainian time to resist.
And Joe Biden has said in the last couple of days that it is the American belief that Vladimir Putin is weighing up the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Joe Biden has also called Putin a war criminal. What intervention would you like to see from Joe Biden in particular?
International community and the United States particularly closed their eyes when Putin used chemical weapon in Syria against civilian population. Putin was never punished for everything, war crimes which he did in Chechnya, Abkhazia, Ossetia, Transnistria. And now it's a time to stop the circle of impunity.
3 million people now have fled. You say, though, that other countries must do more to protect civilians.
Because we have 14 million of population and only 3 million left. It means that at least 37 million remains, and millions of these people are in dangerous zone, in destroyed cities and villages, in real threat to their life.
Are you concerned that as this continues, that the resolve that has been shown by the West to help Ukraine, that might fade?
I totally believe that sooner or later West will provide all necessity assistance to Ukraine, and Putin will see the high price for his invasion and will stop. But I don't know how much people in my country will remain and will be a witness of this gesture.
You met Joe Biden, didn't you, back in 2014? I saw again from your Twitter feed that you posted a photograph of that meeting, and you made a request of him at that when you had that conversation. Will you explain to us a little bit about what you said?
It was a very short meeting. Joe Biden came after Revolution of Dignity when the war started with Russia, because in order to stop us on democratic transformation, Russia started occupation of Crimea and hybrid war in the Donbas. And he asked me how the United States of America can help Ukraine. And I answer, give us a weapon. Because for that moment, we have no army. We have no military equipment. Now we have something, but still not enough to repeal Putin. And I repeat my appeal to Joe Biden.
For weapons. You want weapons.
We need weapons which can protect the Ukrainian sky from Russian shellings and save the life of civilians.
So are you saying then more sanctions are just not going to do what they need to do?
More sanctions can do, but what kind of sanctions? Because when we speak about sanctions, we don't speak about one more or two more people in the sanctions list. We speak about stop trading with Russia. We speak stop buying oil and gas from Russia. We speak about such kind of sanctions.
Are you in favor of President Zelensky sitting down with Vladimir Putin for talks?
sooner or later it will happen. But now it's an imitation of negotiation. Putin will go to a real compromise only when he started to fail.
We spoke a little earlier about Mariupol. Can you explain to me in a little more detail what you're hearing from that city now? And we know, and your president has confirmed this, that it has almost been completely destroyed.
More than 100,000 people remain in Mariupol. They are for a month already without food, water, electricity, medical care, in the basement under the constant Russian shellings. And this is like catastrophe. When I saw the picture from Mariupol, I feel myself in some horrible apocalyptic movie, but it's not movie, it's reality.
You've spoken as well that you are determined to continue working, but it sounds as though it's very difficult because of the way you are living, the exhaustion, the fear and the stress that you're going through.
I have no fear, but we all exhausted, but we have no other option. We will fight to the end.
And where you are, do you have access to the supplies that you need for your day-to-day life?
Yes, I have access. I'm in Kiev, have food, water, electricity for current moment. We don't know what will be within several days, but for current moment, we have.
Alexandra, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. That's Alexandra Matvichuk, who is a human rights lawyer in Kiev.
Thank you.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.